I was fortunate to play at a very good basketball school. And then you go away and you coach and you think that, you know, if I ever had the chance to coach here at Maryland, it'd be great. But I never thought I'd have the opportunity to come back and coach at Maryland.
Trimble with 3 seconds. Trimble for the win!
A sellout crowd of 43,000 cheers Queen Elizabeth and her consort, Prince Philip. Very special guests of the University of Maryland.
90 seconds to go. Vasquez for three in the lead. 78-77, Maryland.
I believe that the Terrapin is the loveliest, perhaps the most beautiful of all trees.
There's Wells to jump out. Make the step. Take it inside the five. Touchdown, Maryland. Terrapins beat Virginia Tech.
And no handshake for the coin toss from Maryland before the game today. It is on.
Okay, grab shell, dude.
Ha-ha! Righteous!
And breaking free for the touchdown is Jay Sean Jones on his first touch as a Terp.
You're listening to Inside Maryland Sports Radio.
On Saturday, Maryland's offense sprung back to life and quite possibly saved its season against a depleted Rutgers, winning the game 48-7. They earn win number 3 and are halfway to the magic number of 6 wins that gets them bowl eligible and what by all measures I think would be a good start to the Mike Locksley era. However, finding the next 3 wins will be significantly harder than the first 3. But luckily for them, next on the list is a Purdue team that's also in complete disarray, and Maryland will have to look to Tyrell Pigrome to bring things home while Josh Jackson's on the shelf with a high ankle sprain. On the basketball side, the long-rumored practice facility has finally been announced, and we have renderings, cost estimates, and exactly how much you'd have to spend to put your name on a meeting room, a locker, or a urinal. And on that lovely note, you're listening to IMS Radio. Today we have with us the publisher of Inside Maryland Sports, Jeff Ehrman, football and football recruiting reporter, Ahmed Ghafir, and as always, I am your host, Paul Douglas. I don't know where the other two guys are. They don't answer texts anymore, so that's how we roll. All right, Jeff Ehrman. Maryland needed that one, and I'll tell you, after the first quarter, it wasn't feeling so good up in old Piscataway.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was just a little bit of a slow start. Rutgers obviously was happy just to pound the ball and let the quarterback run around a little bit. And Maryland probably wasn't quite prepared for exactly what they were going to do since it's a whole different deal without Sitkowski there at quarterback. But, you know, they had that one semi-extended drive to open the game, and that was just about it. You know, Maryland pretty much took over in the second quarter for a while. It did feel like, really, you're going to play down to Rutgers. You know, but Rutgers, we talked about it last week, you're going to have that little high from getting a new coach and the fresh start and everything like that. So maybe they had that little sugar rush to begin the game and then were quickly outclassed.
Yeah, it actually played out a little bit like we would have thought, like, you know, With the coach coming in, I believe that quarterback who played was actually his quarterback at Bergen Catholic, where the current interim head coach was head coach before getting to Rutgers. So clearly those guys knew each other really well, and they scripted a really good first drive for them. And it was a little scurry, I will say. Ahmed, when you look at it, it reminded me of a game from the last couple years where Maryland wasn't necessarily able to sustain long drives, but they just kind of on the big play and Rutgers had no answer for them.
Yeah, I would say the turning point was, and even during when I was watching the game live, I kind of questioned, you know, with Maryland's offensive concerns through that first quarter and a half, they weren't really able to get much going with McFarland. I was thinking, you know, why not put Javon Leak in, more physical back, you know, first play of first carry, he took off the 42-yard run for a touchdown. Maryland went up 21-7. And I think after that point, it was a pretty much one-sided affair. I'd say the biggest takeaway for me was, you know, I didn't expect Rutgers to offensively, if Maryland was able to put up points, I didn't think Rutgers really had the ability to match that. But the front seven for Maryland was really able to control the game. You know, two huge fourth down stops. I think that was definitely a huge, huge momentum builder. I thought it was probably their best game yet this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a defensive perspective, you've seen the green shoots of life here and there You know, yeah, Penn State was ugly, but, you know, for the most part, the defense has done what we thought, Jeff, in the beginning of the season they needed to do, which was just be not terrible, right? And for, I think for the most games, they have been able to pull that off.
Yeah, I mean, Penn State, obviously the only exception there. Otherwise, they haven't been. They've been pretty good, you know. They gave up nothing, obviously, against Howard, 14 against Syracuse, 17 against Temple, and then 7 against Rutgers. That's pretty good. They really haven't played outside of Penn State any really high-powered offenses. But, you know, so I think that that's going to show later when they get into that Michigan-Ohio State stretch, especially at the line of scrimmage. But, you know, they've been pretty solid. I think the defensive backs have, as we've talked about, have been a little bit disappointing overall. But clearly that's not their biggest concern. You know, the biggest concern remains the offensive line.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the struggle you've seen on the outside in the secondary is because, like we figured, you know, Maryland's not able to get much pressure from their front three or four. You know, they need to bring linebackers in. They need to bring guys off the edge, and that's just going to leave them out on an island a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's really valid. Ayinde Ely, I think, has shown some things. He looked pretty good against Rutgers, but they don't have any consistent pass rushers. Even last year, when it seemed like they didn't have much of a pass rush, he still had Byron Coward and Jesse Anibonum, however you pronounce it, two much better pass rushers and much more proven defensive ends than anybody you have on this team. But like you said, we knew that going in. There were no proven guys on that defensive line. They've been able to somewhat overcome it so far, but that's another reason why you better get those wins now in this little stretch they have coming up, because things like those line issues on both sides of the ball are going to be really tough to overcome once the schedule gets miserable in about a month.
Right. Well, you know, just looking forward a little bit, you know, you've got Purdue coming up, and they're an utter disaster. You know, that feels like a game you just have to win. And then you've got Indiana at home and Minnesota on the road. It kind of feels like the whole season is right here in October.
You got to win these next two, absolute must wins. No question about it. Lose either one and you are just not bowling, in my opinion. I mean, you never know. Maybe you pull off some big upset later this season. Michigan's not great, but they're still going to be really hard to beat. Ohio State.
You got Nebraska sitting there.
Yeah, that is true. Let's see. Yeah, you forget about Nebraska because in the preseason, everybody had them being back, which clearly they're not back. They're way overrated just because the Scott Frost factor, everybody bought in. They're not that good. They should have lost to Northwestern at home last week. Northwestern gave them that game, and Northwestern's been terrible. So that is definitely a winnable game for Maryland. You still need to win these next two. I don't know. People are talking about Minnesota as one that they should win. I mean, Minnesota, they haven't played anybody, so like the record is definitely a little bit of fool's gold, but I still think that at Minnesota, then again, they've owned Minnesota. That's Minnesota's like their redheaded stepchild, since they're one redheaded stepchild.
The only one. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Even Rutgers, I guess now they're what, 4-2 against them? 4-2 or 5-2? Has it been 7 years? They entered, I think they're 4-2 against Rutgers now. But you got to get these next two, absolutely, especially because Indiana's at home and Purdue, like you said, is just a mess with all the injuries.
Right. So stepping back a little bit, obviously one of the big stories here is Josh Jackson going down. We're going to get a good look at Terrell Pigrum this time because I'm not sure if we have a full update on how long Jackson's going to be down. But, you know, if it's a high ankle sprain, it's at least going to be, 3 to 4 weeks?
Yeah, most likely closer to a month than day to day.
Okay. So you're going to be counting on Pigrum to get you to that bowl because he's going to be the one in charge the next 3 weeks. I thought he actually looked pretty good, especially in the second half in this game. They had one really long, it was like a 12-play drive that ended up turning into a touchdown in the third quarter, which, I mean, didn't put the game away. The game was already put away. But it just felt like the first time you've kind of seen Pigrum really assert himself and not only use his running skills, but he'd be able to fling the ball around a little bit.
Yeah, he's done that in like little mini stretches throughout his career or the past few years. But, you know, I just don't know how much credence to put into it because it was against such a bad team that had clearly quit by that point, and they were probably working in some of their backups and everything. So, I mean, he looked good, but, you know, the track record with him is that he's shaky. He's, you know, kind of erratic. Obviously, he can run a little bit, but he's not like this, like Michael Vick style guy that sometimes people want to hype him up to be, you know. So, I mean, I think he'll look good. I think he'll be better than he has been in the past. People forget last year, you know, he just about led them back to that comeback at Indiana and then really had Ohio State on the ropes, minus that failed 2-point conversion. But, you know, if anything, it might make them a little more fun to watch, especially after how Jackson struggled the past few weeks. You have a little more dynamic ability to your offense, and, you know, you have an option at least of seeing the quarterback on 3rd and 6, you know, make the defense pay and scramble for a first down, where Jackson's, you know, a little on the slower side and doesn't seem to like to run all that much.
Yeah, yeah. Med, get into Jackson a little bit and his play to this point. I mean, I kind of wonder if we've seen the best of him already, and I'm not sure that he's got the goods.
Honestly, I think the play from the offensive line has really been that bad. And even Loxley alluded to it a little bit this week, the protection issues. Josh Jackson's kind of always got he's just kind of always looking out to see who's kind of coming after him. So it does hamper the way he's able to affect his reads. So I do get that. He's obviously he was missing the short throws. But I would say the one thing that kind of stands out to me about Pegram coming in as quarterback this year versus last year, I thought that Canada, obviously he was just too rigid in his offensive philosophy. So, you know, his style did give Pegram an ability to use that mobility and to, you know, flash his arm. But, you know, Maryland really wasn't pushing the ball downfield too much. I would say with Loxley, it sounds like there's going to be a little bit more optimism about, you know, how the way they tweak the offense. Obviously, it's going to be the same sets. It's going to be a lot of the same packages, but just the RPOs that you are able to run with Piggy. And I'll actually give Josh Jackson credit, because I don't think I would definitely not classify him as a dual threat guy. He's definitely not a quick guy, but there's been a couple times on some quarterback option plays when he's actually able to make a defender miss with a one cut. He's actually done, I think, 2 or 3 times now that's caught my eye. He did it against Rutgers. But Pegram, just with a guy like McFarland, you know, especially with some concerns with Pegram's arm strength, I could see Maryland going with a 2-back set where you have McFarland and Javon Leak in the backfield, posing that threat with the constant run. And it gives you the option to either hand it off to McFarland, or he can go in the slot or on a swing. Purdue has a really good defensive line. George Karloftis, he's a former 5-star. So I think that's a little bit more of the optimism that I'm kind of getting from Pegram. You know, it's still tough. It's still going to be his first start. So I'm sure with the protection issues, he's going to have his bad moments. But I feel a little bit more optimistic with Pegram and for this weekend.
Yeah, man, I think it's pretty evident that Loxley's base offense fits Pegram's playing style significantly better than it does Jackson. You know, I remember seeing Jackson at Virginia Tech, and he ran a lot more back then. He doesn't seem like he's the same guy coming off that broken leg last year. I don't know whether that's a mentality thing or it's an athletic physical thing, but, you know, you could just see so many times that he would just not take the quarterback option, or even if he did, he didn't seem to have much intent behind it. Like, he would hold onto the ball, realizing that the defensive end was taking the back, and didn't exactly know what to do with it or have much impetus to kind of find a hole and go through it.
Yeah, and I kind of agree. I think, and if you kind of just look back the way his freshman year until now, I think his freshman year, he definitely kind of impressed with his ability to escape the pocket, but then we started to see he had a run first instinct, so he had to kind of fight that, and then you would see some drives during his sophomore and a little bit of his freshman year towards the end, but where he would you'd just be a little bit more hesitant about tucking the ball and running. So I think he's just, it's just the gradual improvement with him. And I know he's been working out with that quarterback trainer over the summer. I did hear some good things. He's just a really resilient kid. He's not going to let some media talk or anything like that hold him down. He really works hard. I'm kind of curious. I think Loxley actually, he did praise Pegram's ability and improvement as a passing quarterback, and said, you know, that was an area of concern, but he's made a lot of strides even since the spring So it sounded like Loxley has a lot of confidence in his ability to run this offense.
Well, he certainly has all the motivation in the world, you know, being a guy who started at the end of last year, you know, who was low on the depth chart for quite a while in August camp and then kind of worked his way back to the point of being that kind of 1B to Jackson's 1A, if that's believable, you know, and now they're going to get to game plan for him, which I really think, you know, we haven't seen yet. We've seen bits and pieces of Pigrone being able to play, coming in at certain times during certain drives, especially being given drives early in the game at times this year, but he's never been game planned for. They've never scripted a series for him. So I think what you see that first series against Purdue will say a lot about what we're going to see with him behind behind center.
I mean, he's just going to have to be able to force or show that he can extend or move the ball with his arm, because if I'm Purdue, I'm probably just going to put seven in the box and blitz him.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that'll be interesting too, because not only does, you know, that dare him to throw, but when they do that, if they come up into that two back set, it feels like when teams have stacked the box, especially from Temple forward, Temple Penn State, when they play with the two backs in the backfield, they've been able to kind of bust through that and use a lot of misdirection to kind of get by his out of position. So I'll be interested to see if they put more of that out there. Ahmed, do you have an update on the injury situation? Because I know it's been a mess with the offensive line and everything else, but I thought that Miner and Jordan, some other guys, were in pads this week.
Yeah. So both of them were practicing, both of them in pads. You know, it still sounds like they're going to be evaluated on a, you know, game day basis. But it sounds like there's a little bit more optimism this time around that Johnny Jordan and Marcus Miner are going to be able to go. You know, Miner's obviously recovering from the dislocated toe. You know, it should shift Ellis McKinney back to right guard, kind of strengthen the offensive line a bit. But I actually did think Spencer Anderson made some pretty nice plays, and Austin Fontaine last week too. Sounds like Maryland should be able to get some depth back this week. Much needed depth against
Purdue. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, if you want to look at the bright side of some of this, you know, a game like that against Rutgers, I thought the right side of the line, being Spencer Anderson at right tackle and Austin Fontaine at right guard, actually did have some pretty good moments at times. They were getting blitzed pretty bad in the beginning. And, you know, pass blocking has always been the issue with these Maryland offensive lines the last few years.
Yeah.
You know, getting these guys real game time is a plus in a game that you end up winning 48-7.
Yeah, definitely. I thought, like you mentioned Fontaine, he's actually on a couple plays pulled really well on some blocks. He moves really well. I know he played an offensive line in high school, but yeah, he looks good. So, you know, it looks like he's going to provide some good depth for the years to come.
And boy, do they need it. Okay, so Purdue next week. Indiana game time announces a 3:30 game. Bless us all. No breakfast tailgate for one time this year, other than the night game.
I didn't think that was allowed in Maryland. I thought the game had to be done by 3:30.
I know. It's some sort of College Park city ordinance. But no, we actually get to have a real tailgate, which has been rare. So, awesome. All right. Ahmed, we didn't have you last week to go over the wreckage of the recruiting cycle after the Penn State game. Maybe you just want to give us a little base value of kind of where we're at the moment, and if there's anything that's popping up that people should know about.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
All right, thank you, Ahmed. Moving on to basketball.
Yeah, let's just skip it. But yeah, let's just leave it at that, honestly. There was one kid, I'll keep it pretty generic. You know, there was one kid that they're working to flip. He attended the game, spoke to his coach afterwards, asked about the chances of a flip. He said, F no. So that was one of many reactions that I got. So if you're wondering why there was not many reactions on the site, now you have your answer.
Well, it's probably at its worst directly after a game like
that. Yeah, so. I mean, I try and wait. So, you know, give a kid a day or two to, you know, say, oh, I like the atmosphere, I like the talking with the coaches. Yeah, I mean, it was not great. So
that's why you got to win these next few games, right? I mean, nothing is going to take away the dings that you took when that loss, the lack of momentum and branding and whatever else. But if you get these wins and you get to a bowl game, then you, at least you have something to sell. And I'm mad we'll have more good news to deliver, you know. But if you kind of just peter out here and end up at four wins or whatever, that's going to make it really tough. I mean, nothing, like I said, nothing is going to erase the effect that had. It was just the worst case scenario on every level, but that just makes winning these games even more important to try to give you a chance of selling, you know, going back to a bowl for the first time. And what's it been now, 3 years since the bowl game? I guess Durkin's first year is the last time I think they went to a bowl.
Yeah.
Boston College.
Yeah. Got to win these next two and set yourself up to where you can beat either Minnesota or Nebraska. And then, you know, Loxley will have something to work with. But, you know, that, I don't know. We've already harped on how much that Penn State loss hurt them. So I guess there's no reason to rehash all of that.
Yeah, but I mean, it talks about the way that you can save a season. I mean, you know, if it's, you know, mid-November and Maryland's sitting at 6-4, you know, with Nebraska coming to College Park, like, that's a very different scenario than the one coming off of that Penn State loss. Like, you can take that and sell something with it. You can say, okay, like, yeah, well, that sucked, but you can be part of what's going to turn this around. You know, like, this is where we're at. We've got a decent baseline here. We're trying to add you to make it better, you know, as opposed to just repeating the last couple seasons where it's just this endless struggle where, you know, they get to 4 or 5 wins by, you know, mid-October and then just lose out every year. I mean,
obviously the loss is bad, but you know, kind of a reason why that Loxley's the coach and so highly touted is because, and especially now it's his first year, you're able to say, like you said, we have a good baseline, but Loxley's kind of able to sell the ability to build on that, like you said. He's kind of able to reach out to guys and sell those needs, but he does a really good job of using a lot of his guys on the team to be able to turn that to recruiting. Like Nick Cross, I know that he's very, very active. And another thing is going to be recruits. Once recruits are committed to coaches right now, by December 1st, there's going to be a lot of coaches that are on their way out. So a lot of the flip targets that, you know, are on the fringe or outside looking in, you know, we see it every year. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, there's all kinds of coaching changes. Guys move around. So guys are going to be able to reconsider. I would say just from experience in covering these long shot kind of recruiting is you just have to be in the mix until signing day. Once signing day hits, if you're still in the mix, if you're still had that relationship, you're going to have a shot. So Loxley does a great job at that. Even though that there's not a lot of optimism in the flip targets right now, they're playing the long game. So we're about halfway through the long game. So
that's a great point. That's a great point, Ahmed, because, you know, you got to go with track record until proven otherwise. Loxley's track record, even though right now it all might seem like doom and gloom from that Penn State game, is, you know, he pulled Stephon Diggs at the last minute when Stephon Diggs wasn't even considering Maryland before he arrived. And Randy Edsall was the coach and there was no buzz. He pulled Nick Cross last year. I mean, he's done this all throughout his career. He got those guys, Aurelius Ben to out to Illinois and all these other guys. So that's what he does. So even every year with him, you know, even at this point with Maryland, every year it might seem like it's like you can write off all these top kids. He's going to pull off a surprise or two late in the game, regardless of how the rest of the season goes.
And last year, again, they had to establish relationships in a very short span. Now they have an entire year. So, you know, a guy like Taj Capehart, that first year under Durkin, you know, he had a very strong relationship with Tech early on, committed. But Chris Beatty played the long game, continued to use his deep roots, Virginia roots, to kind of keep showing why Maryland. And the weekend before signing day, no one expected him to really waver on Virginia Tech. He was supposed to be the jewel of the class. And then 48 hours, I remember at 1:30, I got the text that said on Monday night that he was flipping to Maryland. So, just kind of reinforcing what we said, but that's a good example of it.
Yeah, you just got to be the guy still standing at the bar when the music comes on at 2 a.m. Like, if you're there, you still got a shot. You know what I mean?
Like, heard that, brother.
I got a lot of
man who was in that position many times.
A lot of experience in my years doing such a thing. All right. Okay. So there's some hope on the recruiting front. And, you know, that's the other thing, too, we talk about the way you talk about this class. I mean, Maryland's already got the majority of its class locked up. So, you know, it kind of gives you the flexibility to try and work some of these potential flips, you know, stay in the game late, hopefully lock up most of your class in the December period. And then you've got the next 2 months to kind of, you know, work on the jewels and see if you can pull off a miracle. So I think that's one of the scenarios where the early signing day really comes to help a school like Maryland too. Okay. So let's move on to basketball. Jeff, I believe they're doing the Midnight Mile, which is Maryland's new version of Midnight Madness. I guess the old version of Midnight Madness too. Is that tonight, tomorrow night?
I believe it's tonight. I'm not positive though. I mean, it's a non-event at this point that we're not even covering because there's nothing to cover. Like,
right.
Anthony Cowan looked really fast. His stride looked good, and he was very courteous to the students running next to him. So, right. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of sad, I guess, probably to many, especially those who've been around for a long time and realize that Maryland started the whole Midnight Madness thing, but, yeah, they've moved on to this. And I mean, people, and the surprising thing to me was not that many people even complained about it. I mean, there were a few little complaints, but that's just how low that event had sunk well, into the point that
they already themselves. Yeah, they already killed it. I mean, you can't kill something that's already dead. You know what I mean? Like
yeah, it was The Walking Dead, but it was dead.
Right. The minute that they took it off of Midnight and tried to make it a family-friendly event, it stopped being about the students, it stopped being cool, and that was it. Like, it's just been a slow, like, 10-15-year death march since that date.
Yeah, I mean, they need to take a page out of Kansas's book, get some stripper poles up.
Snoop and strippers and money guns.
That was awesome. Funny how big of a deal is being made out of that. Like I saw on I was watching, I think it was Outside the Lines maybe on ESPN today, and they were like going in depth on that. Bill Self will have his first comments since the, I mean, it was, you know, it was tacky. Is he even that edgy anymore? I mean, he's got to be like 75 years old at this point. The money thing, thing is kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, it was right after they
get money at the players and the recruits, but.
Well, right after they get banged by the NCAA for show cause. I mean,
it's not like the NCAA is going to be like, oh, now we're going to get them. You know, they're just trolling us now with Snoop Dogg. It was tacky, I would say. But they just need to get hammered. The NCAA just needs to hammer them, make an example of them. It's long overdue, but we're getting off on a side tangent.
No, but we've talked about Kansas. I mean, look, we all know how the game is played here, but Kansas is by far one of the worst operators in that.
It's funny because the layman's perception is that, you know, until now anyways, in the past, it was the public perception was that they were just squeaky clean, traditional, you know, like North Carolina. Not that Carolina is squeaky clean, but they're not a renegade program, putting aside all the academic fraud stuff. But now everybody, and I've been beating that drum for years, telling people they don't realize just how dollar bill gets down, and it's finally come out. But you know, NCAA probably won't do anything about it till after the season, and we all know what the track record says will happen. But I got a sneaky feeling that they might just finally make an example out of them. I feel like the post FBI investigation era might be a little bit different now. Like the NCAA needs to kind of save some face and show, you know, since it was kind of shown up by the FBI.
No, I think that's right. I think under normal circumstances, they might be able to squeak past this and, you know, get Cleveland State in trouble. But I kind of feel like the NCAA I know we're way off on tangents now, but I feel like this is relevant too. I feel like the NCAA is basically on its deathbed at the moment. And, you know, because they got it coming from all ends. They got, you know, the FBI doing their job on corruption. They've got the state of California passing that law that will potentially start letting players earn money on their own. You know, like the NCAA needs to reassert itself and soon, or they will not, you know, all these schools are going to look around and realize that they're not needed anymore. Like, they can just do this stuff on their own.
Yeah, the power is shifting in the other direction toward the athletes. Clearly, you know, when you look at the changes with the redshirt rule now that you can leave, you can redshirt within four games instead of just playing one snap, with the transfer rules being loosened up and everybody getting a waiver, with the upcoming, you know, the one and done is going to be gone. Kids are going to go straight to the NBA probably in a couple years. So all the power is shifting away from the NCAA.
Yeah, it's really going to have some long-term effects. And I think that affects how people see it. I mean, you know, if you're someone who feels like the players have been abused and kind of taken advantage of for so long, this is great for them. But if you're just like a college football, college basketball fan, you know, you've kind of got a status quo bias here. You don't want things to change. And I think if you're the NCAA, you know, your best bet is you better start getting on top of really kind of nailing these schools when they break the rules. And if I were them, I would also consider figuring out a way that they can start to divert some money to the players before all these other states are going to get their own ideas about how they can legislate this stuff.
Yeah, it's not just Jay Billis whining about it anymore. It's the public sentiment is strongly in favor, I would say. Not that there aren't plenty of people still, oh, they get a free scholarship, I had to pay to go to school, why shouldn't they? And that has grown to be a really loud chorus, not just a little side cause. So they're going to have to figure out a way to pay kids, whether it's through endorsements or otherwise. I don't know how the hell you figure that out with Title IX and with smaller schools where the players aren't generating even a fraction of what they are at Duke or even Maryland or wherever else. But we're definitely in a time of transition right now with college sports.
Yeah, it's coming. They better do something about it or they're going to get run over in the process. Okay, tangent over. Speaking of money, Maryland's got some money and they're dropping it on a basketball performance center, a private basketball facility that will be attached to the Comcast Xfinity Center. Still the Comcast Center. I don't care. I don't, whatever. Jeff, tell me about the building, what they've got, what kind of details we have on this project.
They just announced it yesterday officially. You know, the news has been kind of, word has been out behind the scenes for a while. We've been reporting on this for 2 or 3 years probably, while several heavy-hitting boosters and Mark Turgeon behind the scenes have been working to try to make it happen. It's taken them a ton of work to get this thing off the ground, especially at the same time as the coal facility redevelopment. Obviously, that kind of delayed it. It's hard to have two big capital investments like that, two new facilities, especially on a fan base that isn't exactly roaring with eagerness and donations, you know, like the Terrapin Club. For I think the Terrapin Club, I was told right now, has like 6,000 members, which is insane. A school of Maryland's stature, and with Maryland's alums and, you know, and the affluence of most of their alums, or a lot of their alums, and just the general size, to have 6,000 or 5,000 boosters is beyond pathetic, to be honest. But anyway, so...
Well, hold on. While you're there, I want to point out, though, part of the reason for this is that new tax law made these donations. You know, they used to be able to, when you were donating money for the purpose of buying tickets, even, you'd be able to take a tax write off of 80% of that amount of money. You can't do that anymore. So
yeah, but the membership was already extremely poor before that. I'm sure that probably cost them a small percentage, but even before that, it was well below 10,000, which, you know, these other schools, you know, I can't even imagine what it is at like a Nebraska. I bet you they have 200,000 boosters. I mean, hell, they get 60,000 people out to watch a recruiting event. So that's, you know, but
yeah, it's next level at these other places.
Yeah, that's beside the point. You're never going to be in Nebraska. You should still have more support. But anyways, my point is that if you only have that many boosters, you better have some heavy hitters chipping in on this thing, because they're doing it all privately. They say they're not going to use any state funds. And they've raised, I guess, about half of the $37 million budget that they're that they've put forth. So anyways, it's going to be a 60,000 square foot building, you know, all the amenities that all these new facilities have, player lounges, obviously the practice courts, a weight room that's four times the size of their current one. You know, Turgeon said it wasn't about keeping up, you know, in the arms race, but, and it's true, because it, another thing that's ridiculous is Maryland basketball has had to split practice court time with like the volleyball team and work around all these other teams, which is, I mean, you're Maryland basketball, you know, you shouldn't be like trying to figure out who's got next on the court. But they've had, they have had to do that for years. So that they'll, you know, they'll have their own dedicated facility now, and it's huge for recruiting. You know, the fact that they, along with Boston College, were the only two Power Five conference schools without a dedicated facility is just kind of a good thumbnail sketch of the under exertion of Maryland athletics in the past 20 years. You know, their profile is way higher than all these other, not all, but a lot of these other schools. You know, you look like, you know, schools like say Butler or San Diego State, they have these nice, and Maryland doesn't have one. That's so people kind of scoffed at Turgeon quietly complaining behind the scenes over the past several years and about not having one, but it really was, you know, an embarrassment. I don't want to say embarrassment because most people don't even notice, but it was a handicap for both recruiting and, you know, team development. So now you have something to show kids with your fancy lobby, with all, with your Maryland Hall of Fame and all this stuff. You get your fancy players lounge and locker room and stuff like that helps in recruiting. Kids, teenagers like stuff like that, believe it or not.
Well, and just, you know, the idea that if the you know, kids want to shoot around or something, like they've got to, you know, they've got to make sure some other team isn't using the court.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's hard to imagine a school on Maryland's level where you're borrowing practice time from non-revenue teams, you know, so, but it's not like it's going to happen tomorrow. This thing's going to be several years in the works, and they're still trying to raise money even through the UM Terps website, you know, asking for donations for this other $10 million. It's going to be hard to piece that together through $50 here and $100 there.
Yeah. A buddy of mine got an email the other day. You know, he's a fairly big booster, but you know, not like a baller by any stretch. And he's like, oh, I got this invite to this, this event, you know, with Turgeon and, you know, Damon Evans and everybody else, you know, I'm really excited for it. I'm like, don't bring your checkbook, because they're going to take it from you, dude.
Yeah, they got, I was just told they raised the first $19 million out of, I had the number, I can't remember how many. It was a relatively small number of donors, maybe 30 or 40, yeah. Several of them, you know, obviously putting, I'm sure Kevin Plank is putting in some money, even though he hasn't exactly been enamored.
I have informed that he has not put any money in this, and that Under Armour will not.
Yeah,
Under Armour will not contribute to this or put naming rights on any of it either.
It was hinted to me that he might have been talked into it, but I don't, because he's, you know, Harvey Sanders, obviously most people know the super booster who was this, spearheaded this whole thing. He's on the Under Armour board and very close with Plank. So maybe he got him to, it was hinted to me. I don't know. There's no telling who put exactly what in, but yeah, I mean, good luck raising that other $15 million or so. That's going to be interesting to see how that works out.
Well, I do have a listing here of naming opportunities for anyone, any bold listeners out there who may be interested in contributing to the new facility. Now, if you want to name the facility for yourself, that's a cool $10 million. So if you got that lying around, you know, slap your name on this new building. It'll be sweet. Both the practice gyms are $5 million apiece. The lobby is $5 million. The courts themselves, so I imagine just like the hardwood, are $2 million a pop. Locker room complex, $1 million a pop. Office suites, $1 million a pop. New strength and conditioning room, $1 million. Coaches locker room, $500K. Sports medicine room, $500K. Offices, $500K. Conference rooms, $250K. Support staff offices, $100K.
Custodial closets, $2,000.
The urinal, each urinal is $5,000.
So, how do you, I don't know how you convince people to pay those for a practice facility. like someone on our Devils on our message board made a great point. It's a practice facility. It's not like it's an arena where you have, you know, 15,000 fans and all kinds of foot traffic and, you know, corporate branding and everything like that. It's a practice. I could see maybe the one spot on the outside of the building, sure, because people drive by it all the time. But like the practice courts, how many people who aren't inside baseball, Maryland basketball kind of people are going to even ever see the basket, the practice courts for $2 million? So I mean, I hope they get it.
You're trying to tell me that nobody's going to see the Paul Douglas urinal in the locker room? Nobody's going to know that was mine?
If I see your name on it, I'll use it.
All right. I appreciate that. Appreciate that. But yeah, so they're obviously, they have their hands out on this one. And, but you're right. I mean, it's something that they just had to do. I mean, everybody has one now that, you know, there are positives in terms of revenue flow and things like they will finally be able to have concerts and stuff on campus at the Comcast Center, because before they couldn't, because they needed the goddamn court so often because they had nowhere else to go. So like, some of this stuff is just so bush league on Maryland's part that it's gotten to this point. You know, it's, I'm kind of just glad that, you know, Hall of Fame Harvey has finally gotten enough pieces to the puzzle together to make this work, because, you know, whatever you think of Turgeon or anybody else over there, like, this just needed to happen.
Yeah, it's too, I mean, to not have a, they were the only Big Ten school without a football facility a couple before.
Yep.
Oh, weren't they? Nobody else?
Or Rutgers, maybe. Yeah.
And then with this basketball thing being one of the last, I mean, those are just pretty good examples of the long-term lack of excellence, you know, not necessarily coaches or AD who are there now, but just in general of Maryland athletics over the years, not to have those things. And then also just the lack of that, again, Nebraska-style fan base that's just going to shell out for stuff like that. That's what makes it a tough deal for Maryland.
I'll tell you what, there's a book to be written by someone about how Maryland was so unprepared and wasted the national championship in Ralph's early years, because there was never quite fervor for Maryland sports like that was, and the athletic department just had no idea what to do about it. And I feel like all that has led to this, but yeah, that's another story.
Fell off a little bit, you know, Gary. Yep. Had declined, and here we are.
Here we are. Speaking of declining, everyone who Maryland has recruited to be their point guard next year has declined their offer and gone somewhere else.
Oh, that's Jeff, well done right there, man. I'm going to have to tell Larry you did that.
Dude, that was completely off the fly. I was so proud of myself, I couldn't even finish the thought. But yeah, here we are. Do you have any update about what the hell they're doing about point guard? Or are we just winging it right now?
Really, there's no new names. I mean, we've gone over all the guys who passed or who went elsewhere before they came to visit. We reported on Kareem Main about a week or so ago that they were kind of moving on from him because he's going to take till the spring to make a decision and they need to get somebody before then. So I'm sure they've got some secret candidates, and we've reported on a few 2020 kids that they've been recruiting at other positions, but there's not like a known commodity, and I'm sure somebody will pop up. If there's one thing Turgeon's been pretty good at, it's scrambling to find another option if you know, things fall through. But right now, that doesn't seem to be a lot of action on that front. That's the big question, because it's probably, you know, once Sticks inevitably leaves for the NBA after this year, then you will have one more scholarship that I'm sure they'll use. But as of right now, I think that's the only one available right now is to use for a point guard.
All right, is there any other relevant news in terms of basketball recruiting at the moment?
There's a couple official visitors that I reported a couple days ago. Luke Good will be in soon. He's a point guard, both 2021 kids, point guard from Indiana, number 90 player in the country, shooting guard, I should say, number 90 player, number 19 shooting guard, just basically a three-point shooter. And then they might have an official coming up from Aminu Muhammad, which is interesting because he is a stud, top 15 player in 2021. A lot of local ties. His guardian is a local who's been around the Maryland program for a long time. And so they've really been pushing hard on him. I mean, it seems like every week I hear that they're out to see him in Missouri where he's playing, where he's moved to play his career, where, you know, his brother plays for South Missouri, is it Southern Missouri, South Missouri, what the, Missouri State, whatever's in Springfield, Missouri, whatever the hell school, Missouri State. So yeah, I think he'll most likely be in for an official in the next few weeks, and you know, maybe pull off a home run there with that whole getting the first visit strategy this time around.
Yeah, that's going to be super sweet when he commits and then decides to go to the NBA because they get rid of the one and done rule.
I think it would be the following class that would be affected like by that.
You think so? You're good.
But he also is another one who's talked about maybe reclassifying up a year, very casually. It's not like some of these kids who are almost sure to do it, but he's casually mentioned it. So, you know, he could end up being a recruit for next year.
And you could potentially see him as a sticks replacement. He's kind of like a big three, small four kind of.
No, I would say sticks is, this kid's more of a 2-3, I would say. So not really sticks replacement, but just not necessarily a replacement for anybody. Well, unless Wiggins leaves, but just a guy who's too good not to take. I mean, he's a stud. He averaged almost 20 a game as a freshman in the WCAC. His numbers last year at this school of Missouri are just ridiculous. It's like 35 points, 11 rebounds, 7 blocks, 4 steals, something crazy. I mean, he must be playing against like Walter Johnson.
Playing a bunch of Ermans.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, either way, that's definitely one to watch.
All right, cool. We'll keep an eye on that. We'll keep you posted. Maryland's got Purdue this weekend. That will the result of that game will greatly affect our disposition as we record next week. Thank you for joining us. As usual, we are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are all over the InsideMarylandSports.com message boards. We are IMS Radio, and we are out.